this time. But you should use caution with her from now on. Retrain her. Even a few weeks on her own may have been enough to turn her wild. Twin drops of blood dot Peter's arm. The wound is not bad. As strong an Aaron as he is, the venom will only cause a little redness. I have salve that will help, Catherine says and goes into the other room to fetch it. Peter eyes the snake ruefully as he holds his wrist. Reacting was the right thing to do. Catherine would have been sick with the venom for days, even after receiving treatment. But he did so without thinking, and he had been afraid that Catherine would be hurt. Truly afraid. Only a king consort is fool enough to love a queen, he says quietly. Wolf Spring. Arsinoe and Billy walk side by side through the winter market. Since their introduction and their afternoon at Dogwood Pond, it has proved difficult for Arsinoe to get away from him. But in the market, Arsinoe does not mind. Jules is often with Joseph, and without her there, Arsinoe feels exposed in crowded places. In bustling parts of town, like the market, wicked glances sting like bees. Any in the crowd could grow brave enough to reach around and slit her throat. Arsinoe? Billy asks. What's the matter? She studies the surly winter faces of fishmongers she has known since she came to Wolf Spring. A good number of them consider her weakness a disgrace and would see her dead. Nothing, she says. Billy sighs. I am not in the mood for the market today, he says. Let's buy something to eat and walk up into the orchards. It's not too cold for that. On the way, they stop at Madge's shellfish stand so that Billy can pay for 2 fried stuffed clams. He barely fumbles with the coins this time. He is learning. They eat quickly as they walk to keep them from getting cold. Madge stuffs her clams with chunks of crab and buttered breadcrumbs. When she feels particularly generous, she dices in some nice, fat bacon. As they walk past the docks, toward the road that heads up over the hill and into the apple orchards, Billy stares down at his clamshell, turning it over in his hands. Staring at it won't make it grow a new one, Arsinoe says. You should have bought 3. He grins and draws his arm back to throw the shell into the cove as far as he can. Arsinoe throws hers as well. Mine went farther, she says. It did not. Arsinoe smiles. Actually, she could not tell. What happened to your hand? Billy asks. Arsinoe tugs her jacket sleeve down to cover the scabbing from the new rune she cut into her palm. I cut it on the chicken coop, she says. Oh. He does not believe her. She should have made up something else. No chicken coop could leave behind such an intricate design, and she still has not told Jules what she and Madrigal are doing. Junior, she says, looking closer at the docks, where is your boat? The slip where it has bobbed since Joseph's return is empty, and the entire cove looks darker because of it. My father's returned home, he says. It is easy enough to come and go, a short sail to the mist and through it. My God! I feel mad just saying that out loud. Matter, knowing that it's true. Easy to come and go, Arsinoe mutters. Easy for anyone but her, anyway. But listen, when he returns... What? He intends for me to meet your sisters. We're to travel to Indrid Down and the Arryns, and Queen Catherine. Of course. He wants his son to wear the crown. He has no particular loyalty to the naturalists, no matter how fond he became of Joseph during his banishment. You never call me Queen Arsinoe anymore, she notes. Do you want me to? She shakes her head. To be called a queen feels like a nickname, like something that only Luke calls her. They walk up the road and then wave to Maddie Pace when she rumbles past in her ox cart. Arsinoe does not need to look to know that Maddie has twisted around in her seat to stare at them. The whole of the town is interested in their courting. I don't know if I want to meet the rest of you, Billy says. It feels a little like befriending a cow on its way to slaughter. Arsinoe chuckles. Be sure to tell my sisters that when you meet them, she says. But if you don't want to meet them, then don't. My father isn't the sort of man you say no to. He gets what he wants. He won't have raised a failure. And what did your mother raise? She asks. And he looks at her, surprised. It doesn't matter, he says. She never wanted this. You know mothers. They'd keep us attached to their apron strings forever if they could. I do not know that, Arsinoe says. I do know that you sound a little like you are sulking. Don't forget the difference between what a lost crown means for you and what it means for me. Yes, you're right, I'm sorry. She looks at him from the side of her eye. It cannot be easy to be a stranger here and to give up everything familiar for a crown and an unfamiliar life. He's tried to be fair, and she should try also. And she should keep her distance. It will not be easy for him to see her dead, should they become close. But she has so few friends. She cannot turn one away. Arsinoe pauses. Without thinking, she has turned them onto the trail that leads to the woods, and the old stones, and the bent-over tree. No, she says, and changes their direction. Let's take another path. What do you think your sisters are like? Billy asks. I do not know and I do not care, Arsinoe says. They are both probably in training for the quickening ceremony, less than 3 months now. Beltane, Billy says. It's held every year, isn't it? Yes, but this year is different. This Beltane is the start of the Ascension year. I know that, he says. But how is it different? Does it still last for 3 days? Arsinoe cocks her head. She can only say what she has heard. Neither she nor Jules has ever attended one. To go, you must be at least 16. It is still 3 days, she says. And there is always the hunt, the ritual hunt to provide meat for the feasts. Then normally there are daily blessings and rites that the temple performs. But this year there won't be much of that. Everyone will be preparing for the disembarking the night after the hunt, and the quickening on the night after that. The disembarking, he says, where you are presented to the suitors. Where the suitors are presented to us, she says, and punches him in the arm. All right, ow. And the quickening. That's when you demonstrate your gift. How are you going to manage that? He asks, and braces for another hit. Arsinoe chuckles instead. I thought I would learn to juggle 3 herring, she says. Catherine will eat poison, and Mirabella. Mirabella can fart cyclones for all it will matter. The island will love her best. Fart cyclones, Billy says, smirking. Yes, you would like that, would you? He shakes his head. And after Beltane is over, that's when you are courted, officially, he says. And when we can kill one another, Arsinoe says. We have a whole year to do it, until the next year's Beltane. Though if Mirabella comes charging like an angry bull, I could be dead within the week. They tramp through snow, ice-crusted from melt, into the resting earth of the orchard. They walk deeper down into the valley until the birds stop singing and the wind breaks. Do you ever wonder what happened to your mother? Billy asks. After she had you and left the island with her king. King Consort, she corrects him. And no, I don't. There are stories, of course. Tales of great queens who left the island to become great queens again on the mainland. Others tell of queens who live out the rest of their lives peacefully and quietly, with their consorts. But Arsinoe has never believed a word. In her mind, every last queen lies at the bottom of the sea, drowned by the goddess the moment she was done with them. Jules runs her hand through the dark hair at Joseph's temple. It is soft and long enough to twist around her fingers. They are alone in the Sandrin house today. Joseph's father is out on the Whistler with Matthew, and his mother and Jonah have taken a carriage to Highgate to secure hardware for the boats. It is a good thing, too, since Billy's father sailed home to the mainland and robbed them of the use of Joseph's cabin. This is just as uncomfortable as on the boat, Joseph says. He lies half on top of her, with Camden stretched across their lower legs. I didn't notice, Jules says. She pulls him down and opens her mouth beneath his. From the way his arms tighten around her, she can tell that he does not really notice either. Someday soon, though, we will have to find a bed big enough for the two of us and your cougar. Someday soon, she agrees. But for now, she is glad of the cramped quarters and the lack of privacy. As much as she loves Joseph, she is not ready to go further. With Camden hindering their movements, she can kiss Joseph for as long as she likes, without feeling they ought to do more. Joseph lowers his head and kisses Jules's collarbone, where it peeks through her disheveled shirt. He rests his chin against her and sighs. What is it? She asks. Your mind is on something else today. My mind is only on you, he says. But there is something. What? Do you remember that boat in our western slip? He asks. The shiny little day sailor with the new deck and fresh stripe of blue paint? Not really. The Sandrin's shipyard has been full of jobs like that for months. Vanity repairs from all along the coast. Mainlanders will arrive on the island soon, and the island wishes to show a fresh face. They have even had jobs from the fishers of Wolf Spring, who say the word mainlander through curled, disdainful lips. They may speak of mainlanders and spit, but they will use that spit to shine their own shoes. What about it? She asks. I'm to sail it up to Trignor to return it to its owner. I leave as soon as my mother and Jonah return from Highgate. Oh, Jules says. Why does that trouble you? Joseph smiles. It will sound foolish to say so out loud, but I don't want to be parted from you, even for a short time. Joseph, Jules laughs. We have been together almost every moment since you've returned. I know, he says, and I will not be gone long. If the winds are good, I can reach Trignor by nightfall. It should not take more than a few days at most to catch the coaches back to Wolf Spring. Still, he pulls himself farther on top of her. Perhaps you could come with me? Traveling on a small craft with Camden and long days of rumbling coaches does not sound pleasant, but being with Joseph would make it so. She slips her arms around his neck and hears Arsinoe's voice. Jules and Joseph, inseparable since birth. I can't, says Jules. I have neglected Arsinoe enough already. She's had to work on her gift with my mother, and I can't ask her to take on any more of my chores. She's a queen. The best queens don't mind extra chores. Still, Jules says, I shouldn't leave her here, and you should not ask me to. You love her too, remember? As much as you love me. Nearly as much, Jules, he says. Only nearly. He drops his head to rest against her shoulder. We will not be parted for long, Joseph. Don't worry. Rolanth. The dream is a bad one. Mirabella wakes to the sound of her own cry. It is a sudden waking. The edges of the dream blur into the familiar air of her bedroom, her body trapped half inside each consciousness and her legs tangled in damp sheets. She sits up and touches her face. In the dream, she had been crying. Crying and laughing. Her door clicks open softly and Elizabeth pokes her head in. She has taken over much of Mirabella's personal escort, and Mirabella exhales, relieved that it is her outside her door tonight. Are you all right? Elizabeth asks. I heard you shouting. Pepper the woodpecker flies from her shoulder and flits around the queen from hip to head, making sure she is safe. I heard it too, Bree says. She pushes the door wider, and both girls go inside and close it tight behind them. Mirabella tugs her knees up to her chest, and Bree and Elizabeth climb onto the bed. Bree flicks her wrist, and lights the candles on the dresser. I am sorry, says Mirabella. Do you think I woke anyone else? Bree shakes her head. Uncle Miles could sleep through the Battle of Barden Harbor. Sarah's and young Nico's rooms are too far away. So is the servants' quarter on the first floor. It is only the three of them, one wakeful spot in a darkened house. Mira, Bree says, you are trembling. I'll get some water, says Elizabeth, and Pepper lands beside the pitcher and chirps to guide the way. No, Mirabella says, no water. She stands up to pace. The dreams of her sisters cling to her, sometimes for days. They do not fade like other dreams do. What was it? Bree asks. Mirabella closes her eyes. This one was not a memory, but a series of images. It would be impossible to describe, she says. Was it about, Elizabeth asks hesitantly, the other queens? The other queens, yes. Her sweet sisters dead and stuffed upright in chairs with greening skin and stitched shut mouths. Then a flash of Catherine, lying on her back with her chest cracked open. Nothing inside but a dry red hole. Finally, Arsinoe, screaming at her without sound because her throat is too clogged with thick, dark blood. Mirabella, they said. Mirabella, Mirabella. I held them underwater, Mirabella whispers. In the stream beside the cottage. The water was so cold. Ink came out of their mouths. They were only children. Oh, Mira, Bree says, that is awful, but it is only a dream. They are not children. They will always be children, to me, Mirabella says. She thinks of what it felt like when Arsinoe and Catherine went limp and rubs her hands together as though filthy. I cannot do this anymore. Luca will be disappointed. She has put faith in her and raised her to rule. So have the Westwoods and the city and the goddess herself. She was created to rule, to become the queen the island needs. If she goes to see Luca in the temple, she will tell Mirabella that exact thing, that these dreams and these feelings have been put in her path for a reason, as a test. I have to leave, Mirabella says. I have to get away from here. Mirabella, says Elizabeth, be calm. Take some water. She accepts the glass and drinks, if only to please her friend. But it is hard to swallow. The water tastes like something has died in it. No, I have to go. I have to leave. She goes to her closet and pushes open the doors. She rifles through cloaks and dresses, all black, black, black. Bree and Elizabeth stand up. They hold their hands out to try to stop her, to try to soothe her. You can't go, says Elizabeth. It's the middle of the night. Mira, you will not be safe, Bree adds. Mirabella selects a dress of lined wool. She puts it on over her nightclothes and opens a drawer for long stockings. I will go south. I will not be seen. You will be, Elizabeth says. They will send a party after you. Mirabella pauses, still trembling. They are right. Of course they are right. But she has to try. I have to go, she says. Please, I cannot stay here anymore and dream of my sisters talking to me from dead bodies. I cannot kill them. I know that you need me to. I know that is what I am meant to do. Mira, says Bree. You can. I won't, she says fiercely. Elizabeth and Bree have moved to block the door. They are sad and worried and moments from waking Sarah and alerting the temple. Mirabella will spend the rest of her time until Beltane locked in Luca's rooms and under constant guard. Mirabella steps into her boots and laces them. Whoever they send after her will certainly catch her, but they will have to work for it. She steps forward, ready to force her way through her friends. Wait, Elizabeth says. She holds up one hand and goes out the door. If she calls down the hall, there may not be time for Mirabella to run. But Elizabeth does not call out. She comes back into the bedroom, carrying her white priestess's cloak. "Take this," she says. "Keep the hood up and your hair covered." She smiles her sweet, gentle smile. No one looks twice at a priestess. They only bow and get out of the way. Mirabella hugs her gratefully. The cloak is a little short, but it is large, cut to cover Elizabeth's ample curves, and covers Mirabella's dress completely. "Elizabeth," Bree says, but then stops. She takes Mirabella by the arm. "Let us come with you, at least." "No, Bree," Mirabella says gently. "I would not have you know anything of this. When they find me gone, they will seek someone to blame, someone to punish. Do not let it be you or Elizabeth." "I promise," Bree says. "We will look after each other." Mirabella smiles sadly and touches Bree's face. "I have never seen you look so frightened," she says and hugs her tightly. "Please understand, Bree. I love them, just like I love you, and I cannot stay here and let the temple force me to kill them." She releases Bree and holds her arm out for Elizabeth. She has been lucky to have them. By the time Mirabella makes her way south, through and out of the Westwoods grounds, dawn has started to pink in the east. It must have been later than she thought when the dream woke her. Already, fires and lamps burn in the city as early tradespeople and smiths prepare for the day. She tugs the white cloak down to conceal her face. She takes the main road into Rolanth. It might be wiser to keep to the secondary passages, but that is the way she knows by coach, and a slightly greater risk of being seen is better than becoming lost. When the road turns toward the locks and the city center, Mirabella holds her breath at the sound of people. Ahead on the sidewalk, a woman beats dust from a rug and calls a morning greeting to a neighbor emptying a bucket into the gutter. Mirabella keeps her head low, but Elizabeth was right. The woman does no more than nod before stepping out of her way. If anyone wonders what a priestess is doing in the city at such an hour, none of them stop her to ask. As she leaves Rolanth, she looks back once, across the rooftops and the softly smoking chimneys, her city in the growing light. Beyond that, settled back in the tall evergreens, Sarah and the rest of Westwood House will be waking. In the temple, Luca is probably already having tea. It is difficult to leave them, but getting out was easier than she thought it would be, all things considered. Wolf Spring. Beside the fire, beneath the bent-over tree, Arsinoe's head spins. Madrigal has cut deep into her arm this time to let enough blood to soak 3 lengths of cord. The cord will keep the blood until they have need of it, and for low magic strong enough to kill another queen, they will need all that Arsinoe can spare. They have not discussed yet what that magic will be. A curse, perhaps, or an unlucky charm. It does not matter. All Arsinoe knows is that she grows stronger every day. "That's enough," Madrigal says. She lowers the cords carefully into a glass jar. "These will not keep forever. We should put them to use right after Beltane." Madrigal slides the jar into a sack of black cloth and slings the strap across her body. "Here," she says, and presses a cup of something to Arsinoe's lips. "Cider. Take some." "Did you bring any nuts?" Arsinoe asks. "Bread? Anything to eat?" She holds the cup shakily and sips. The sides of the cup are sticky and smeared with Madrigal's fingerprints in Arsinoe's blood. "Jules is right," Madrigal mutters. "You are mostly stomach." She hands the queen a small packet, cheese, and a dozen naturalist-ripened blackberries. "Thank you," says Arsinoe. Her arm throbs and stings as Madrigal cleans and binds it, but it is a good sting. In fact, Arsinoe has not felt this hopeful in her entire life. "I never would have guessed," Arsinoe says, "that you would be the one to help me with anything." Madrigal scrunches up her nose. On her, even that is pretty. "Yes," Madrigal says, "I know." She sits back and wraps herself in a warm fur, sulking for never being appreciated. But no one can blame Kate and Ellis. Since she was a girl, Madrigal has preferred comfort to work. Kara used to tell of a time when Madrigal made flowers grow in a swirling pattern, only to pluck them to put in her hair. And this all while cucumbers were dying in the garden. "Where is my Julien today?" Madrigal asks. "Saying farewell to Joseph. He sails northwest up the coast for Trignor." Madrigal stares into the fire. "Lucky Jules," she says, "to have a boy like that." I didn't think she had it in her, what with those funny eyes of hers and looking like her father the way she does. "Her father?" Arsinoe asks. "I didn't think you remembered Jules's father." "I don't, not really. I remember the fires of Beltane, and thinking how wonderful it would be if I conceived a baby on that sacred night. How strong she would be. How much she would love me." She snorts. "I don't remember who her father was. But she does not look a thing like me, so she must look like him." "Do you think he knows?" Arsinoe asks. "Knows what?" "That he has a daughter, and that she is the strongest naturalist on the island." Madrigal shrugs. "It is not likely, and if he did, it would not matter. Beltane begats are sacred in the eyes of the temple, and much like the queens, in the eyes of the temple, they have no recognized fathers." Arsinoe leans back. With the cheese and fruit in her belly, she is warm again and no longer shaky. She stretches her legs out and pushes the soles of her shoes near the coals. "Joseph is so handsome," Madrigal says wistfully. "He is," Arsinoe agrees. "Seeing him and Jules together makes me realize how long I have been on my own. Perhaps I ought to work a spell to bring a lover like that to me." "Humph," Arsinoe snorts, eyes half closed. "You don't need low magic for that, Madrigal." "Perhaps not, but if I used just an inch off one of these cords," she says and pats the black bag in her lap, "I could have the best-looking man on the island." Arsinoe eyes her sideways to make sure she is joking before beginning to chuckle. Before long, the chuckle becomes a laugh, and then they are both laughing. But even had they not been, they would still not have heard Camden and Jules's silent approach. The mountain cat arrives at the fire before Jules does, but it is not enough warning to try to feign innocence. Jules looks from her mother to Arsinoe. "What is this?" she asks. Arsinoe grimaces. They sit below the sacred stones, surrounded by rags soiled by Queen's blood. Arsinoe's sleeve is drawn up above her elbow and shows the bandage clearly. "This is what you do?" Jules half shouts at her mother. "The moment I turn my back, you bring her here and cut her open? You teach her low magic?" "Jules," Arsinoe says and stands. She stretches an arm out as if to shield Madrigal, which only makes Jules angrier. Camden begins to growl. "I am helping her," Madrigal says. "Helping her?" Jules reaches for Arsinoe and tugs her so hard Arsinoe nearly trips over the log she was seated on. "You cannot do this. It is dangerous." Madrigal shakes her head. "You don't understand it. You don't know anything about it." "I know that there's always a price," Jules says. "I know it is for the simple and the desperate and the weak." "Then it is for me." Arsinoe rolls her sleeve down to cover the bandage and the cuts of the runes on her palm. "Arsinoe, that is not true." "It is true, and I will use it. It's all I have." "But you don't know what it will cost." "It will be fine, Jules. Madrigal used it when she was on the mainland, and she is safe." "Those who speak against it are only coughing up temple superstition," Madrigal agrees as she douses the fire. She and Arsinoe walk around the hill silently, eager to get Jules out of their sacred place. Jules follows behind, angry. For as long as Arsinoe can remember, she and Jules have not quarreled over anything more important than the size of a slice of cake. Her shoulders slump. "It will take time," Madrigal says softly, "but she will come around." The Western Coast. It is better when there are no carriages or carts and she can travel by the roadside. At least the air is open there, and she can see a patch of unobscured sky. Mirabella looks up at the fading light. It has been 2 whole days of walking since she fled Rolanth, separated by a few uncomfortable hours of dozing against this broad trunk or that. The country to the south is not meadows and sheer cliffsides. It is made up of denser forest and softly rolling hills. So many trees. Even in winter, without their leaves, they box her in. She does not understand why naturalists love the woods so. She picks up her skirt to step over a mostly thawed puddle in the ditch, trying to preserve it, even though the priestess's cloak that Elizabeth loaned her is edged with dark watermarks and mud. The journey has not been easy. Her legs ache, and her stomach is empty. Yesterday, she used a bit of lightning to stun a trout, but she is not skilled at hunting without the priestesses and their hounds. She misses Bree and Elizabeth, Luca and Sarah, even Uncle Miles and excitable little Nico. But she will bear it. She cannot stop for too long in any one place, and she cannot go often into cities. Soon, though, she will have to trade for new clothes and a meal with a vegetable in it, so her teeth do not fall out. Mirabella steps quickly up the ditch as something approaches on the road. Whatever it is sounds large. Several carriages, perhaps? A search party from Rolanth? She will have to get far into the trees to keep them from seeing her, and her from seeing them. The sight of poor Luca pressed against the window would break her heart. When she is deep in the woods, she stops and listens. Only one carriage passes, probably a rickety wagon headed for Indrid Down, perhaps carrying a load of wool or sheep's milk and cheese. Not long ago, she smelled sheep fields and guessed that she was passing through Waring and its many farms. But she is not certain where she is. She has studied maps since she was a child, but the island looks much smaller on paper, and she has not seen a sign since passing one for North Cumberland early this morning. By now, with the sun setting, she must be at least as far as Trignor, perhaps even Linwood. Another few days and she will have to skirt the boundary of Indrid Down. "Where they will catch you, you silly girl," Luca says in her head. Mirabella brushes black hair out of her eyes. Somewhere to the east, thunder rumbles. Tired as she is, she does not even know if she is the one who called it, but she craves it all the same, and turns farther from the road to follow the scent of the storm. She walks faster as the cliffs and open sky call. Above the trees, rich black clouds roll in, until she can no longer tell what time of day it is, or whether it is crossed into night. She breaks through the tree line. For a moment, she fears that she has somehow walked in a wide circle. The cliffs she stands on are so like the Black Way of home. But it is not the Black Way. A flash of lightning shows the cliff face in white and pale gold, softer stuff than her beloved black basalt. "A little more," she says to the wind, and it races around her and squeezes. It blows the ruined cloak back off her shoulders. Mirabella steps to the cliff edge above the sea. Lightning illuminates the water in greens and blues. There must be a path down. She wants to wade out and be soaked to the waist. The only way she finds is steep and lined with wet rocks. It is treacherous, but she takes her time, delighting in the wind and rain. Tomorrow, the people who live here will speak of this as a Shannon storm, named for the queen whose mural decorates the largest portion of Rolanth Temple. They will talk about it over breakfast tables. It will damage roofs and leave downed trees to clear. People will sing the song of Shannon and tell of how she could summon hurricanes and send them out like pigeons on errand. They are only tall tales, perhaps. One day, they will call great fires a Mirabella flame and say that she could scorch the sun. Or they would have, had she not run away to disappear. Mirabella looks out to the sea and takes down the hood of her cloak so the rain can slick her hair. Then the lightning flashes, and she sees a boat topple down No. The craft is small and the waves rough. Perhaps the storm tore it out from its slip. No one could be unlucky enough to be caught in the middle of such a monster, in a boat as tiny as that. The boat rolls itself and rights again. The sail has come loose and blows wet and flapping. It has not been abandoned or dragged unmanned out to sea. One lone sailor clings hopelessly to the mast. Mirabella looks in all directions, but there is no one down the beach, no town, no glow of friendly fires. She screams for help back toward the road, but it is too far. The boat will roll again and fail to come upright. It will sink down deep and be tossed in the restless currents until there is nothing left. Mirabella holds up her palm. She cannot stand there and do nothing as the sailor drowns, even though she is weary and water has always been her most difficult element. Use the wind, she says to herself. But she has never used the wind to move anything but her own body or a few small belongings, Lucas' scarf or Sarah's hat. Mirabella studies the water. She can try to push the boat back out, far enough into the sea, perhaps, that it might escape the storm. Or she can try to bring it in. Either choice is risky. She could shatter the boat against the cliffs. She could lose control of the water and swamp it. Or the hull could be impaled on an unseen rocky outcropping lurking beneath the surface. She clenches her fists. There is no more time. She focuses her gift on the water around the boat, working it and shifting its currents to slide the small craft toward the shore. She calls too much wind, and the boat jumps forward like a spooked horse. Goddess, Mirabella says, teeth clenched, guide my hand. The boat pitches sloppily back and forth. The boom wags like a dog's tail, and the sailor makes a grab for it. He misses, and the boom catches him clean across the back. He falls over the side and into the sea. No, Mirabella shouts. She uses her gift to sift through the water, separating it down deep. She has never done anything like this before. The ocean's layers, its currents, and cold and churning sand move as she commands. It is not easy, but the water obeys. The boy breaks the surface, cradled in the current she has created. He is smaller than the boat and easier to manage. When he strikes the beach, his body rolls hard onto the wet sand. She did not know how to be gentle. She has probably broken all his bones. Mirabella scrambles down the steep path. She slips and crabs her way, cutting her palms bloody against the sharp rocks. She runs across the sand to the boy and presses her torn hands to his chest. Water drains from his mouth. He is so pale, lying on the edge of the surf. He could be any other sea creature, spit out of the waves belly up. Breathe, she shouts, but she cannot put wind into his lungs. She is no healer. She does not know what to do. He coughs. He begins to shiver, violently, but that is better than being dead. Where am I? He asks. I do not know, she says. Somewhere near Trignor, I think. She takes off her cloak and drapes it over him. It will not be enough. She will have to get him warm, but as far as she can see, there is no cover. This was, she says, and shakes him by the shoulder when he seems to again lose consciousness. This was not the best place to come ashore. To her surprise, the boy laughs. He is about her age with thick, dark hair. His eyes, when they meet hers, are like the storm. Perhaps he is not a boy at all, but some elemental thing, made by the crashing water and the endless thunder. Can you walk? She asks, but he slips away again, shivering so hard his teeth clack. She cannot carry him, not up the trail, and not down the long stretch of beach that might lie between them and the next town. Where the cliffs cut in toward the road, they slant, so the opening is narrower at the top than the bottom. It is not a cave. It is barely an overhang, but it will have to do. Mirabella slips her arm beneath him and pulls him across her shoulders, dragging him, waterlogged and limp. The sand sucks at her boots. Her already weary legs burn in protest, but they manage to reach the cover of the cliffs. "I have to find wood to keep a fire," she says. He lies on his side, shaking. Even if she gets him warm, he may not survive the night. He may have swallowed too much of the sea. Pieces of dark, wet driftwood and blown-down sticks from the trees above litter the beach. Mirabella gathers them and arranges them under the cover of the cliffs into a great, heaping mess, threaded through with seaweed and errant shells and pebbles. She is shaking too. Her gift is close to exhausted. When she calls fire to the wood, none comes. Mirabella kneels and rubs her hands together. Next to the lightning, fire is her favorite. To have it ignore her is like watching a most loved pet turn tail and run away. The boy's lips have turned blue. "Please," she says, and pushes her gift as hard as she can. At first, there is nothing. Then slowly, a tendril of smoke rises from the pile. Soon, flames warm their cheeks and begin to dry their clothes. The fire sizzles and spits when the rain from the Shannon storm hits it. But there is nothing to be done about that. She is too tired to order the clouds away. The storm will pass when it passes. Beside her, the boy's shivering has eased. She rustles him out of his jacket and shirt and spreads them out on the sand, as close to the fire as she can without risk of them catching. She lays Elizabeth's cloak out as well. It will keep him plenty warm if she can get it dry. The boy moans. If only Luca were there, she would know what to do. "Cold," the boy mumbles. Mirabella did not drag him up from the depths and across the sand only to watch him die now. She knows only one thing to do. She unfastens her dress and slips out of it. She lies behind the boy and wraps her arms around him, sharing her heat. When her cloak is dry, she will use it to cover them both. Mirabella jerks awake. After covering them with Elizabeth's dry cloak, she had begun to doze, staring into the fire, and dreamed of Arsinoe and Catarine until the pieces of driftwood became their finger bones, and the knots of wet, steaming seaweed became their hair. They burned and fell apart into charcoal as they tried to crawl out of the sand like crabs. The boy lies in her arms. Beads of sweat dot his forehead, and he struggles, but she holds him tight. He must stay warm. In the morning, he will need fresh water. She can probably find some if she goes up the cliff trail back into the trees. Even after the rain, there will still be ice in the woods, frozen on branches or into logs. Mirabella adjusts her position, and the boy's arm slides around her waist. His eyes open slightly. "The boat," he says. "It is at the bottom of the sea, cracked and broken, most likely, given the force of those Shannon waves." "My family," he whispers. "They'll have to replace it." "Do not worry about that now," Mirabella says. "How do you feel? Do you hurt anywhere?"
"No."
He closes his eyes.
"I'm cold. I'm so cold."
His hand wanders tentatively across her back, beneath the cloak, and Mirabella's pulse quickens. Even half drowned, he is one of the most handsome boys she has ever seen.
"Am I dead?" he asks.
"Did I die?"
His leg moves between hers. "You did not die," she says, her voice breathless. "But I must get you warm."
"Make me warm, then."
He draws her mouth to his. He tastes of salt. His hands move slowly over her skin.
"You are not real," he says against her lips.
Whoever taught this boy to kiss has taught him well. He pulls her on top of him to kiss her neck. He tells her again that she is not real. But perhaps he is the one who is not real, this boy with eyes like the storm. Mirabella wraps her legs around him.
when he moans this time, it is not from the cold. I saved you, she says. I will not let you die. She kisses him hungrily, her touch waking him up, pulling him out of the dark. He feels like he belongs in her arms. She will not let him die. She will make them both warm. She will set them both on fire. Wolf Spring. Joseph's mother had a dream of her son pulled under by waves. It was more than a nightmare, she said, and Jules believes her. Joseph had a touch of the sight when he was a boy. Such a gift had to have come from somewhere. But others were skeptical until the birds returned from Trignor with word he had never arrived. Luke pushes a cup of tea into Jules's hand. He has brought a pot down to the pier with a stack of teacups tucked in his elbow. Sorry, he says, when hot tea splashes over the edge and burns her knuckles. And I'm doubly sorry that I didn't have enough hands to carry the cream, but here. He reaches into his jacket pocket and drops in a handful of sugar cubes. Thank you, Luke, Jules says, and Hank the Rooster clucks on his shoulder as Luke moves through the gathering of worriers and rubberneckers, offering cups. Jules is too anxious to drink. The birds brought with them word of a storm off the coast, a monstrous storm that swung into the island from the wide open sea and devastated land from Linwood to the port at Miner's Bay. Billy steps up beside her and places firm fingers on her shoulder. Joseph is a strong sailor, Jules, says Billy. It's most likely that he pulled in at a cove somewhere to ride it out and went on like nothing happened. We'll hear something of him soon. I'm sure of it. Jules nods, and Arsinoe leans against her on the other side. Camden leans against her legs. Despite words of reassurance, many boats have already left the Sealhead to go out searching, including Matthew on the Whistler, and Ms. Baxter said she would take her Edna out into deeper waters. Jules looks out at the cove. From where she stands on the pier, the sea looks vast and mean. For the first time in Jules's life, it looks ugly, indifferent and unblinking, nothing but grasping waves and a seafloor sated by bones. She has hated the sea only one time before, the night they tried to escape, and it refused to release its hold on Arsinoe. Bobbing against that mist, thick as a net, she had hated it so much she had spit in it. But she had only been a child. Surely the goddess would not hold on to that one bitter spell and wait all these cruel years to send it back to her. I don't know why we're doing so much, someone whispers, for an upstart boy who smells of the mainland. Jules rounds on the small crowd. What did you say? She asks. Her teacup shatters in her fist. Easy, Jules, Arsinoe says and drags down her arm. We'll find him. I won't hear any word spoken against Joseph, Jules growls. Not until he's returned. Not until you can be brave enough to say it to his face. Come away, Jules, Arsinoe says as the crowd backs down from Jules's fists. We'll find him. How? Jules asks. But she lets Arsinoe lead her off the pier. Arsinoe, I've never been so scared. Don't be, the queen says. I have a plan. Why does that frighten me? Billy mutters and follows them off the docks. Arsinoe, Jules, and Billy leave Wolf Spring within the hour on three of Reed Anderson's saddle horses. Arsinoe's and Billy's are long-legged and finely boned. Jules's mount is thicker, stronger, so that it can occasionally support the extra weight of a mountain cat. A change of Joseph's clothes is tucked into a bag behind Arsinoe's saddle, along with a sharp, silver knife. The Western Coast. When Mirabella wakes, she is alone beneath Elizabeth's cloak. The storm has passed, and the fire has burned down, but she is still warm enough from the memory of the boy's embraces. He was her first. How excited Bree will be to find out, if Mirabella can ever return to Rolinth to tell her. She pokes her head out. It is still early. The water does not yet sparkle, but the day has begun to coat the beach with gray, hazy light. The boy sits with his back to her, dressed again in his trousers and shirt, his head in his hands. Mirabella pushes up onto one elbow. Her dress is somewhere underneath her. She considers trying to discreetly slip back into it. "Are you well?" she asks quietly. He turns slightly. "I am," he says. He closes his eyes. "Thank you." Mirabella blushes. He is just as handsome in the day as he was beside the fire. She wishes he would come back and lie with her. He seems so far away. "What?" he says, still half-turned. "What happened?" "You do not remember?" "I remember the storm, and you and me," he says, and stops. "I just don't understand how I could have done this." Mirabella sits up and tugs the cloak around her. "You did not want to," she says, alarmed. "You did not like it." "I did like it," he says. "It was wonderful. None of it is your fault." She sighs, relieved, and moves close to wrap them both in the cloak. She kisses his shoulder and then his neck. "Come back to me then," she whispers. "It is not day yet." He closes his eyes when her lips touch his temple. For a moment she thinks he might resist her altogether, but then he turns and takes her in his arms. He kisses her fiercely and presses her into the sand beside the spent coals. "I don't know what I'm doing," he whispers. "You seem to know very well what you are doing," Mirabella says, and smiles. "And you may do it again." "I want to. God damn it all, but I want to." He pulls back to look into her eyes. She watches his expression change from disbelief to despair. "No," he says. "Oh, no." "What is it?" she asks. "What is the matter?" "You're a queen," he croaks. "You're Mirabella." He backs away. He had not recognized her then, last night. A part of her had wondered, feared, that he would return her to Roland, but a larger part had not cared. "No," he says again, and she laughs. "It is all right. It is not wrong to lie with a queen. You will not be punished. You will not die." "What are you doing here?" he asks. "Why aren't you in Roland? Why do you have a white cloak?" She studies him warily. It is not the fact that she is a queen that he regrets. "What is your name?" she asks. He is not an Aaron. He does not have the coloring. And his clothes have the look of a craftsman, well-worn and many times mended. He must have sailed from a great distance. His accent is different from any she has ever heard.
"My name is Joseph Sandrin."
Mirabella's blood runs cold. She knows that name. He is the boy who loves Arsinoe, the one who was banished for trying to help her escape. She takes up her dress from the sand and slips into it quickly while underneath Elizabeth's cloak. She has slept with the boy her sister loves. Her stomach lurches. "Did you think that I was her?" she asks, finishing the fastenings of her dress. "Did you think that I was Arsinoe?" Given his confusion from the storm and the cold, that might absolve him at least. "What?" he asks. "No." And then he laughs in surprise. "If I had touched Arsinoe the way I touched you," he stops and turns solemn once again, "she'd have hit me."
"Hit him?"
"Yes, Arsinoe always hit first when they were children, especially if she really cared for you." Joseph stares out at the waves. The water is quiet now, shimmering and calm, playing innocent after last night's rages and mischief. "Why did this have to happen?" he asks. "After I waited so long for her."
"For who?"
"For the girl I've loved my whole life." He does not give Mirabella her name. "Fine then, let him keep it." She does not ever need to know, Mirabella says. You are unhurt. You are alive. You can go home.
Joseph shakes his head. I will know. He looks at her and touches her cheek. The damage has already been done.
Do not say that. Damage? Like what happened was something terrible? We did not know.
Joseph does not look at her. He stares sadly at the sea. Mirabella, it might have been better if you had let me drown.
They cannot stay on the beach forever. They dig in the low tide sand for cockles and clams and then dry their re-wetted clothes beside a fresh fire. But they are lingering. Their time is up.
Where will you go? Mirabella asks.
Inland, to the road. I was to ride the coaches back to Wolf Spring. I suppose I still will.
Joseph looks at the queen by his side.
She is nothing at all like Arsinoe, and nothing at all like he expected. He has heard that Mirabella lives as though she is already crowned, that you must drop to your knees if she passes in the street. He has heard she is locked away in the Westwood estate, or kept carefully hidden in the temple. In his mind, she became a holiday ornament, only taken out during celebrations and never to be played with. This Mirabella is not like that. She is wild and brave. Her black hair is not braided or pinned to her head. He wonders if this is the queen who everyone in Roland sees, if all the rumors have been untrue. Or perhaps this Mirabella only appears on beaches after a storm. If that is so, then she is his and his alone. They kick sand over the remains of the dead fire, and Mirabella leads Joseph up the path to the top of the cliffs. It is easier going up than down, she says, and shows him the cuts on her palms. When they reach the top, they walk together through the trees toward the road. You will probably have to walk to the next town to find a coach, Mirabella says. I had been following this road for at least a day, and I did not hear many pass me by.
Joseph stops. What are you doing out here? Why aren't you in Roland, surrounded by your future court?
It sounds like mocking, the way he says that, but that is not the way he means it. He takes her hand.
It is not safe to be out here alone.
You sound like my friend Bree, she says. I will be fine.
It has occurred to me that you are headed south, because Katarine and Arsinoe are in the south.
But that can't be. Movements against the other queens are not allowed until after Beltane, unless the rules have changed.
Have they?
I have been gone a long time.
They have not changed, she says. I slip away on occasion, to be by myself.
It is lucky for you that I did.
That's true, Joseph says and smiles.
I suppose I owe you.
I suppose you do.
They have nearly reached the road, but they are not eager to part. Their steps slow, almost to dragging. When Joseph suggests that he accompany her farther south, Mirabella kisses him on the cheek. One kiss leads to more. They will have so little of each other, they must take what they can. By the time the sun begins to sink, they have not traveled far. But at least, beneath the trees, it is easier to find wood for a fire. The Road from Wolf Spring. Jules uses her gift to urge the horses faster. They have never been so game in their lives. Even so, they and their riders must all rest for the night in Highgate, and upon reaching the outskirts of Indrid Down, Arsinoe uses Billy's father's money to wheedle them new mounts, as well as a cart lead back to Wolf Spring for the horses loaned to them. Jules pats each of their old mounts and kisses their cheeks. They were good, and they will be sore from the speed of the journey. All right, Arsinoe says, let's go.
Wait a minute, at least, Billy says, stretching his back. He is a pampered city son, unused to haste and dozing in the saddle.
I haven't even adjusted my stirrups.
You can ride without them.
Not as well as if I use them.
He reaches for the leathers and the girls give in, taking a moment to adjust their own stirrups. They check and double-check their girths, and Jules feeds Camden a strip of dried, smoked fish. Arsinoe would like to be on the road.